This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
A lot of these practices, I think at one point in time, were kind of idealized and were very expensive and were on the outer fringe of being able to afford them. And now a lot of them have rivaled what regular standard practices are.
If you moved into a new home that was 3 times the square footage, you'd probably expect to see your utility bills go up by a lot, right? Well, our guest this week on Sea Change Radio managed to make such a move without increasing their monthly utilities by a dime. How'd they do it? By approaching home and interior design with a sustainability lens, architect George Bradley and his partner Eddie Baba have succeeded in making a beautiful and livable space while reducing their impact on the earth. I recently toured their elegant San Francisco home and saw for myself how they're using solar panels, strategically placed windows, reclaimed wood, and drought-resistant gardening to make style seriously sustainable. We talk about their process for putting it all together, the increasing affordability of sustainable home solutions like rooftop solar panels and LED lighting, and the growing fashionability of being ecologically responsible.
This is our last goodbye. I hate to feel the love between us die, but it's over. Just hear this and then I'll go. You gave me more to live for, more than you'll ever know.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by George Bradley and Eddie Baba. They have just completed a home here in San Francisco, which is really spectacular and incorporates a lot of sustainable practices. George is an architect and Eddie is a patent attorney. George and Eddie, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So George, let's focus on your general philosophy of architecture. I wish our viewers could see this home, but why don't we try to paint as visual a portrait for them and talk first about your general philosophy and what kind of sustainable practices you try to incorporate in your design.
So I am a decidedly modernist, that I believe in building in a modern way and building with modern techniques and technologies. With that said, I still believe we should be rooted in our traditions and understand our traditions. Growing up in Virginia, actually, I was thinking about this the other day. Actually, I grew up in a small farmhouse where we had just a screened porch and, you know, we had to make do with what we had to get through life. And I think building anywhere with anything, you should be doing that. I definitely believe in clean lines, borderline minimalists. No one can see, but all the details here are very simple in that regard. And I don't, I try not to add on detail that isn't necessary. So everything that's here is absolutely necessary to the actual function of the house as much as the aesthetics of the house.
Can you explain how your principles would be transferable in terms of temperature and efficiency, would be transferable to other climes beyond San Francisco, which is relatively temperate?
Yeah. As architects, we always start with the site. Assuming you have carte blanche and where you could place a building or something like that, we orient the house towards the solar path, predominant wind patterns that are noticeable. And including the solar paths, we may then begin to express, look for vegetation that's apparent on the site that could cool or, I'm kind of geared towards the cooling mode for some reason, growing up in the South and being here in San Francisco. I mean, it's always cool, but.
In terms of the materials you use and incorporating renewables into your grid?
I believe in trying to do what's responsible always, and responsible these days is incorporating what are sustainable practices, whether it be PV panels on the roof to kind of offset your energy use, high-performance glazing systems, which is becoming more and more, it's becoming easier to do on a regular basis. You're sitting in front of a window right now that actually has a coating on it that reduces the UV gain on the house, the solar heat gain inside the house. So we get an abundance of light coming into the house, minimizing artificial lighting necessary during the day, and yet we're not getting the super duper solar heat gain.
Why don't you give a brief summary of some of the other projects you've worked on and are working on and how they informed this house?
Yeah, I had the great fortune of working on a number of residences from Utah and in California. And these, again, different climates. The one in Utah and Park City is clearly a cold climate with where they get 6 feet of snow on the roof. So that comes to structuring the house and how do you heat the house efficiently. And that's usually dealing with the high-performance windows that we just mentioned, also the insulating inside the walls. I mean, typically you have an R21 roof, which is an insulating value in your roof, but there we had R40 to compensate for heat loss out of the roof to make sure we didn't lose any heat there.
This is in Park City.
That's in Park City. In a warmer climate in Los Altos, which is just south of San Francisco.
Much warmer than San Francisco, however.
Anybody
who knows the microclimate of San Francisco realizes you can go 20 miles north or south or east and you're in a very different climate.
So there, again, it's a warmer climate like you just mentioned. But there was all passive cooling by the fact that we built the house around a courtyard. So there's a central exterior space. And we put low windows around the outside perimeter, and then high windows, transom windows, along the courtyard. So basically what happens is a convection of air. So cooler air enters the house low and actually rises to the transom windows above the, you know, looking out onto the courtyard. And this actually starts to pull a draft through the house and keeps the house cool that way. Again, we used, because we were in a warmer climate, we used extended roof overhangs to help shade the glazing during summer months. And then during the winter months, the sun actually heats the house because the sun is lower and can get inside the house. So those are simple practices that I think I do this on a regular basis, that it's become second nature.
And on somebody building a new home or doing a major redo on their home in a place like Los Altos, they would normally have forced air conditioning, central air heat, yes, in their home. But you went about this differently, correct?
Correct. We had no forced air in the house in Los Altos. We didn't even use any ceiling fans in the sense that, the exposed ceiling fans. There are whole house fans, which are placed in different locations, which actually help to exhaust. Should there be a heat buildup, if you had the house closed for an extended period of time, you can flip the switch and the heat begins to dissipate when you're using this whole house fan. And then again, always using high performance glazing, because the courtyard, I should mention, in the Los Altos house is lined with glass on all sides. So it basically allows an abundance of light into the house, which is another theme that I think is prevalent through my architecture, is just light. I love light.
So where were you living before, George, before this home?
We had a loft in South Market. The loft is 1,200 square feet. And what we found very interesting is once we moved in here, the energy bill is the same cost. So to run the 1,200 square foot loft and to run this 3,000 square foot home, single family residence, is costing us the same amount of money.
Amazing.
That's just a tribute to the efficiencies of the equipment, the efficiencies of the building materials that have all made a difference.
And I'm looking at your high-tech looking thermostat. Is that a Nest or what is that?
That is a Nest thermostat, which we have throughout the house. It's a learning thermostat. It does know when we're here and when to turn it on. The technology that's becoming more and more available to us across the board, whether you're building a new house or renovating house is that you get to use this technology. That's a learning technology. It's helps your, the biggest energy hog in your house is your heating systems or your cooling systems. And it's a learning thermostat that literally can keep the house temperate. And these technologies make sure the house is running at optimal performance.
Another thing that was important that we did was we divided the heating system into five different zones. And so each zone can be heated separately from the other zones. And so you can avoid waste in heating in that way to dictate based on what your, what areas of the house you're going to be using. For example, down here with the spare bedrooms, we're not down here as often. And, you know, when we have guests, we will heat this area up. But when we don't have guests, there's no need to actually heat this area of the house. We can just heat the zones that we're actually in, like, for example, the family room and just the master bedroom. And that way we can control costs associated with it and reduce the amount of waste.
And with that, talking about the heating system again, it's a radiator, radiant heat throughout the house. We have a high efficiency boiler that actually provides all our hot water needs for the house, including the radiant floor and our domestic hot water. And these boilers are getting more and more efficient, which should and could be replaced in any home.
They probably cost a little bit more, but did you do any kind of math on how long it would take for it to pay for itself compared to your standard heater?
We didn't do the math for the standard heater itself, but we did do the math. I'm going to jump to photovoltaics, because with the system for photovoltaics and the credits you get from government benefits, it would take us 10 years to get our money back on the system. But that assumes that the cost of energy does not increase over the next 10 years or increases at a very modest rate. And for us, it was about being responsible. Like, we feel that we're building something that's long lasting and that we're trying to take advantage of the technologies again that we have today to reduce our kind of footprint here. It takes a lot of energy to build a building. So when you can begin to offset that over the life of the building, that's where you become a winner and sustainable.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with architect George Bradley and patent attorney Eddie Baba. Thinking of the materials that have to go into a proper cooling system, I was in Europe this summer, and first of all, nobody has air conditioning, but they learn to be sensitive to the climate. If it's hot out, they close those windows in the morning and keep that cool air in so that when they come back from the day, it's not sweltering the home. We don't have 14th century stone buildings to work with here in Los Altos or San Francisco, so you have to use airflow and shading as a kind of a workaround, or are there materials that you can incorporate that will kind of heat sink, so to speak?
There are materials that you can incorporate into projects for heat sinks or for a kind of a mass. And that's by adding mass to the house, which is what they do, I mean, which is apparent in the European places with the stone. But for instance, this house is built on a concrete plinth, the house we're in right now. And that is concrete walls that actually hold the heat. So if we went down to the lower floor of the house, it becomes cooler because the mass is against the earth, the concrete, and that's actually keeping the house cool. For radiant floors, another means of holding heat, which were, if you went to holding the heat, you could put that on a concrete slab, which actually we're sitting on right now, is a concrete slab. That once you heat that mass, it dissipates very slowly. Like once it's heated, it's a slow kind of heat gain and heat loss on it. So for efficiencies, that's a great way to maintain temperature, a standard simple temperature in the house. And you can run it lower too.
So one of the first things you notice about this house is the really beautiful redwood siding on the outside. You were able to find reclaimed redwood for this home. How does one go about finding it?
We connected with a wood broker who had reclaimed redwood from wine vats. So we went down and visited him in Hollister.
Was his reclaimed redwood cheaper than...
Reclaimed materials are starting to have a premium because of their gaining value in the sense that they are reclaimed materials. So people are starting to understand that we're not wasting resources, we're actually reusing resources, and they do have a bit of character.
That's interesting. So like our values have changed so much that the price of a reclaimed material can be more expensive than the new one.
The reclaimed redwood from wine vats was running around $8 a board foot. We met with this individual for about 5 hours. We were talking, we were looking, we were calling, we were going through everything. And then he pulled out this board that he said, oh, I'm about to buy this material. And it was the tongue and groove boards from the very tip top of Hangar 1 at Moffett Field, which is the Air Force base just south of the city here in Mountain View. It was originally installed in 1929, and it's probably 100-year-old redwood when it was installed. You just can't cut these trees down anymore.
If you've ever been up to the Valley of the Kings up by Mendocino, you know, the giant sequoias of California, that's what they essentially forested for this wood. I mean, it was sad that it was done. And another way it was done, and we're happy to have given that wood a second life in a second form. At this point, you just can't get wood like this. It's almost illegal to forest 150-year-old, 200-year-old redwood trees to just use as decking material. and it's just beautiful. And when we saw it immediately, the grain, and to think that this was used as decking material underneath the tin roof at the very top of Hangar 1, and it was hidden underneath a thick layer of lead paint, and it sat there for, you know, almost 80 years or so. And we were able to get it and strip it and apply it and give it a whole new second life. And to have people see the beauty of it, it was just incredible.
One of the other kind of things that brought us or drew us to that wood as well is the house that was originally here was built in 1941. And the lower garage, which is a concrete bunker, was a bomb shelter originally in 1941, permitted as a bomb shelter. And then when you came into the house, we have a small triangular front yard, which is facing Roosevelt and Park Hill. There are two round buoys out there. They're buoys that were used to net the bay against submarine attacks during World War II. So we kept with this circa World War II era kind of history or lineage of the house and the materials that went into it, to kind of give the house a story, the materials a story, and how we reuse them thoughtfully.
Why don't you explain some of these art pieces that are here in your television room?
I'm on the board of directors for an organization called Creativity Explored. It's here in the Mission in San Francisco, and it's a visual arts center for people with developmental disabilities. And it's a place for them to create gallery and sell art. And the proceeds from the art sales go to them as living artists. It's a fantastic organization, and we've been involved with it for many years. And a lot of the artworks throughout the house are actually from artists at Creativity Explored.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with architect George Bradley and patent attorney Eddie Baba. And we're here in their spectacular new home in San Francisco. Frequent listeners of Sea Change Radio are aware that we're always looking for good policy and bigger picture ideas when it comes to sustainability and being environmentally friendly. What kind of lessons do you think, in terms of design and sustainable practices, can be applied to much less expensive homes?
We're in a perfect room for this example. LED lighting above us right here. You could switch out existing incandescent lights with newer LED lighting, which pulls a tenth of the power. And that is, they have bulbs these days that can be changed into an incandescent bulb. And another thing that's bothered a lot of people in the past is the color of the light. It was too white and harsh, but they've learned how to change the color temperature, which is how you change what you see. So this is actually a warmer light coming from these LEDs right now.
So it's not like having a Audi driving right at you anymore.
If you have the opportunity, getting more efficient appliances, such as refrigerators and dishwashers and washer and dryer machines. It sounds small, but our old machines of old are NG hogs. Even the water use in our washing machine, it's so minimal. I'm kind of amazed that the clothes get clean, but the new technologies really do a great job in kind of using limited sources.
And how do LEDs compare in terms of price from standard bulbs these days?
You can probably add about 10% to the cost of an incandescent.
That's it.
The whole light fixture itself.
Oh, I thought it was significantly higher.
Yeah, they've gotten definitely, it's coming way down. It's becoming more and more accessible. Like, I just think incandescent, much better than fluorescent as well, because the light quality is what we're kind of all going for. And they're high output LEDs, so these can get actually quite bright.
And in terms of design, George, who are some of the cutting edge architects in this region that are paving the way for more efficient homes that more people can afford?
One of the firms I admire most here in the Bay Area is Leti Matum Stacey. And they're doing an amazing job at integrating sustainable practices in large buildings, buildings for individuals who are once homeless. Seven-story buildings, eight-story buildings, large condo buildings. They're integrating, of course, photovoltaic PV panels on the roof, shading of all the windows from, different facades have different shading to counteract the sun and solar heat gain. And their last, they have a whole gray water system, which is using basically wastewater from sinks to water the outside lawn and things like that. So that's just one of their buildings recently finished here in San Francisco that's doing great strides. And they actually bring that mentality to all of their work. And that's what makes them so admirable to me, is that across the board, they are winning and teaching us all how to be better architects.
A lot of these practices, I think at one point in time, were kind of idealized and were very expensive and were on the outer fringe of being able to afford them. And now a lot of them have rivaled what regular standard practices are.
For example, the LED light.
Yeah, just as very simply the LED light. And having somebody who's involved in design at least be on, you know, the cutting edge of what these technologies are and what the where the prices have changed. And rather than just simply speccing out something like a normal light, going the extra distance and trying to find an alternative that will be better and, you know, might be 5-10% more expensive, but over the life of that building is going to make a big difference in energy consumption and usage. And being aware of those practices is, I think, very, very important, as much as just the general design. George, you mentioned Lady Madam Stacy, and most of the time people would think like, oh, sustainable design or anything like that would be a little bit more stodgy on the design aspect. But LMS does incredible work. I mean, it's on the top end of most design practices, and the results are incredible. And on top of that, they have the great practices when it comes to sustainability.
And they're working within a fairly strict budget, I'm guessing.
Exactly. So they're doing a lot of these projects that are for low-income housing or formerly homeless housing. So, you know, they don't have unlimited resources to be doing this. And if, you know, they can do this for these projects, then most people can definitely do it for their homes. It's just a matter of putting in a little bit extra effort on the research and trying to find those options.
Now, being in the midst of a severe drought here in California, how did you approach the outside part of the house, the grounds? Lawns are pretty much antiquated ideas for new California homes, aren't they?
Yes. The plantings that we did outside are all drought tolerant or low water. And we did Core 10 materials for planter boxes and reduced the amount of solid surfaces like concrete paths and everything to allow rainwater to actually seep into the groundwater naturally and not kind of run off into the sewer system. So we're trying to hold as much water here on the site and not overtax our sewer systems and just have it go into waste. We're using what are Mexican feather grasses, which has zero water being fed to it, agaves, and cactuses along the front. And again, we chose these materials because we thought they were beautiful and complemented the redwood, but also they have the low watering component to it, so we can stop the water when we need to, and they will live. Also, Eddie is very good at planting succulent gardens up here on the roof deck. So again, those plants never get watered up here. It just takes from the natural. We do have a lot of fog here, which is enough to feed the succulents. So again, not going out of our way to have lavish, lush greenery.
But it's subtle and beautiful.
We'd like to think.
Well, thank you so much for bringing me into your home, and for hopefully Sea Change Radio listeners can follow the links on seachangeradio.com to view more pictures of what this looks like. George Bradley and Eddie Baba, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Jeff Buckley, Talking Heads, and Delanium Bonney.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.